All righty. Good morning, everybody. This is Bible 231, November 24th. Nice Monday. And it's almost Christmas time. It's amazing. See, is that, yeah, I guess that's working. Okay. So we were in the vascular chapter last time. And that's where we're gonna finish up vascular. So let's take a look at the overall schedule. 24th, we're gonna get into lymphatic system today. And when is the next test? It is two and a half weeks away. And these are the chapters 19 through 25. Yep, all those chapters right there. And also on that Wednesday, the Wednesday lab will have a practicum. The Monday labs will have their practicum on Monday before the last test. So don't forget that last test is not cumulative. It's just over these chapters that you see right here. Any question on the schedule? Yes, hi. Yes. Yeah, there's a lab. So on the 8th. Oh, on the 8th. Oh, good question. Okay, there is no lab on the day you have the fourth practicum, all right? Because some groups have one lab left. There's only one lab that has two labs left. So we won't have a lab that day. It will just be a test. And maybe the Monday group will have the practicum and then the last quiz to make sure that you get all the quizzes that you're supposed to get. So if that's the case on Monday, then we'll take the practicum and then go outside and sit outside and take the quiz, the last quiz. Okay? All right. Yeah, so there is no lab that day. Okay, good question. Which I didn't answer right until I looked at the schedule. Okay, any other questions on the schedule? You're pretty much good with that? All right. Well, where were we last time? We were looking at all these different arteries, and most of these are really easy to appreciate. Okay, but let me go over a couple more. So I'm going to zoom way in. Okay, so here is the aorta, right? And the aorta has a number of different divisions to it. We have the ascending, the arch, and the descending. And the descending goes from where I have the cursor right now all the way down to the iliac arteries. So that's all aorta. But the divisions are ascending, arch, and descending. The descending is broken down into two parts. There's a thoracic division, which is behind the heart, which we can't see on this illustration, but that's the thoracic aorta. And then the abdominal aorta, as soon as the aorta goes through the diaphragm, okay, here is the abdominal aorta down to the common iliac arteries. Okay, so I do want you to know some branches off the abdominal aorta. I'm not so concerned that you know branches off the thoracic descending aorta. Okay, but I do want you to know the vessels on the arch, of course. You've got brachiocephalic, common carotid, and subclavian, and the carotid and subclavian are on the left side of the body. All right, but I would like to know, what are the first branches off the aorta? What's the first branch? And they come off almost identically. They come off at the same level. Brachiocephalic is the first branch off the arch, but I'm wondering, is there a branch off the ascending aorta? This is the systemic circulation, and I see it right here. Here is a coronary. This is the left coronary. Here is the right coronary artery. So the first branches off the aorta are the coronary arteries. Those are going to be right in the valve leaflets for the aortic semilunar valve. All right, and then you got the brachiocephalic, common carotid, and subclavian. All right, so subclavian just means what? Underneath the clavicle. Then we get to the axillary, somewhere near the head of the humerus. And then down mid-diaphysis, here's the brachial, right? And then we have the radial and ulnar arteries, depending on whether it's a medial or lateral side of the forearm. Okay, this is what I really would want to go over today. The branches off the abdominal aorta. So the abdominal aorta is just a division of the descending. And the way that I want you to think about this, this works really nice for me, right, and probably for most people. So I'm going to zoom in maybe even a little bit more. Nice. Okay, so there are paired branches and unpaired branches. Guess where paired branches go? What kind of organs do paired branches of the aorta go? To? Yeah, kidney. But to organs that you have a pair of. And you have other organs that you only have one copy of, right? So some organs that you have two copies of would be the kidneys, would be the adrenal gland, right? And the gonads. What's a gonad? Testes or ovary, right? Okay, you got two of those. All right, so let's look at the single branches first, unpaired visceral branches. I see one right here. This is the celiac trunk. Celiac trunk is going to bifurcate into arteries that go to the spleen and the stomach. That would be gastric, right, and small intestine. But this is an unpaired branch because there's only one coming out. You only have one stomach, right, one spleen. So this is the first unpaired branch. The next one I see is unpaired as well. This is going to go to mesenteries. So we call this one the superior mesenteric. And then way down over here, I see another unpaired branch. That's the inferior mesenteric. So you get celiac trunk, superior mesenteric, inferior mesenteric. All the rest are paired branches, like the renal arteries that are going to the kidneys. There are adrenal arteries that go to the adrenal glands. And then here are the gonadal arteries, way up in the abdominal cavity. And of course, depending on what the sex of the individual is, right, they're going to go either to here or way down over here. But that's a might hit you as kind of a funny place for these arteries to originate. All right, so break down these arteries into paired and unpaired branches and kind of understand why. Okay, adrenal arteries. Sometimes we call those the suprarenal arteries because they are superior to the kidneys. All right, all these other things we look at in lab pretty nicely. There's a couple other things that I do want to show you. Where do I have it? Oh, wow, I don't have a little cheat sheet for you guys. Okay. This is pretty good. Okay. Okay, so let's look at this slide. You see the arch of the aorta, and here's a vessel that's bringing blood to the head and also to the arm. So this right here is the brachiocephalic. Brachiocephalic bifurcates into the common, carotid, and subclavian. And let's look at the subclavian just a little bit. If we get into the subclavian, the first branch off the subclavian is this artery right here. Look where it is going. Where is it going? Here's a really good, clear example of where it's going. Can you tell where is it going? Cervical vertebrae. What's that thing in the cervical vertebrae that it's actually going through? Yeah, the transverse foramina, right? And so this vertebral artery goes right through, and that's why only cervical vertebrae have that foramina, and then it goes into the skull or into the cranium, right? So this is what we call the vertebral. Here it is labeled, vertebral artery. I don't want you to know any of these other branches. Let's look at the common carotid in a little bit more detail. I see that it bifurcates. It splits into two. There is an external and an internal. The internal is going to go through the carotid canal into the cranium. And which one looks bigger? The internal or external? Okay, the internal, right, because it's bringing blood to your brain. And this area right here is not labeled on your slide, but this is what we call the carotid sinus. You see there's kind of a little bulge right over here, a little bit of a bulge. I'll really zoom into this region right here. And this is a very interesting place because right here there are sensors for pressure. We call those baroreceptors. All right, so these receptors send information to the medulla oblongata so that your brain is always monitoring what your blood pressure is. So if it drops, right, it can compensate by increasing your heart rate or force of contraction. If your blood pressure is way too high, it might be able to cut back on the rate of contraction of the heart. So this is important for that reason because it helps control your heart. But another reason, because of the structure, because of this bulge right here, there is a lot of pathology associated with it. It has a tendency to dissect, which means rip apart, but also it forms plaques, right, and spasms. And when it forms a plaque, where is that plaque going to go if it breaks away from the artery? Here's the internal carotid. Where's that material going to go? Right into the brain and cause a stroke. Right? And so this is probably the most commonly imaged part of the human body in hospitals because a lot of people have disease of the, what did we call this? Draw it in there, carotid sinus. All right, so that's right here. Nice ultrasound study is pretty easy to do. All right, so the other thing that I see on this slide is we always want to bring good blood supply to the brain. And we see that the internal carotid is bringing blood to the brain and the vertebral. As a matter of fact, those are the only two arteries that bring blood to the brain. So that is noteworthy. So if you lose one, the others can kind of take up the slack that the others should be doing. All right. Now, why is that? All right, so here are the two vertebral arteries. Here are the common carotids. The internal carotids right here. So these are the only four blood vessels that bring blood to the brain. Notice that the vertebrals, anastomose, are joined together to form the basilar. There's the basilar artery. And then the basilar is going to connect with something we call the circle of Willis. Do you see this circle right here? All right, so here is a vascular plexus. Right, that means that if blood can only get through the right vertebral artery, it can still go to the left side of the brain via the circle of Willis. Right? Or if there's an internal carotid that is blocked, right, the internal carotid on the other side, and both vertebrals can bring blood to the brain because it's so important that we keep the brain well perfused with oxygen and nutrients. All right, so we got the basilar artery, posterior communicating, anterior cerebral artery, and posterior cerebral right here. All right, so what is the function? What does this remind you of in terms of the nervous system, the circle of Willis? What does that remind you of? How about a nerve plexus? Remember what the job of a nerve plexus was? It was to allow important signals, right, to take alternate routes to get to important organs in your body. So that if there was damage to one nerve, then signals could still get through the nervous plexus to get to that important organ. Same thing for this vascular plexus, right? So if there's disease in the vertebrals, then the internal carotids can do the job, right? Or if there's disease in one carotid, then the other carotid in the vertebrals can supply the whole brain with blood. So that's pretty important. All right, so that's the circle of Willis that I want you to know something about. All right, so we're going to go down to veins really fast. All right, so here we have a nice sagittal section. I don't know what happened there. Somebody turned the volume way up. Or maybe my transmitter died. Is it green? Okay, no, transmitter's okay. Don't know what happened. Okay. So here is the superior sagittal sinus. Right, this is within the meninges. Probably you remember what the meninges are. Right, and then So here's superior sagittal sinus. There are some other sinuses that drain blood from the brain. This is what we call the confluence of the sinuses. This is getting blood from pretty much all over the brain. And then here is the sigmoid sinus, and the sigmoid sinus then drains into the internal jugular vein. Right? So in this particular case, a sinus contains venous blood. You've learned of sinuses that have all kinds of other things like air, for instance. Right? But here's one that contains blood. And then here are some veins, right, in the transverse plane. So we call these the transverse, right, because it's coming from midline all the way over to the sigmoid. So here's a transverse sinus here and here. Okay, what about these veins? What do you need to know about the veins? Well, veins are pretty much named after the arteries that they course with, which are named after parts of the body, right? But there are some examples where that is not the case. So let's zoom in. What is the big artery that's in the neck? What's in the neck? The carotid arteries. Okay. Well, there aren't any carotid veins. All right, but what we have in the neck is a jugular. So here's the internal jugular, and this vein goes underneath a clavicle, so this is the subclavian vein. So when the jugular right here and the subclavian join together, right, then that vessel, little segment right here, becomes a brachiocephalic, right, brain and arm. That's where that term came from. There's a brachiocephalic on the left side. Right, so here is subclavian artery, and here is the internal jugular. When they meet, then that segment from here to here, that is the left brachiocephalic. And on the practicum, if that's labeled, make sure you put down right or left. Now, do you have to put right or left for the brachiocephalic artery? Brachiocephalic artery?
No.
And what's the reason for that? Because there's only one. That's right, there's only one, so we don't need to say right or left. Not so for the veins. When the brachiocephalic veins join together, then that makes the superior vena cava. Right. And I can also see the inferior vena cava over here as well. Right. Then pretty much all of the other vessels have the same name. Except for this medial vein in the arm, that's the basilic. And the cephalic is over here, even though it's not going to the head, right? We're going to call this the cephalic, right? And then the brachial is right in between, but it's posterior, so it doesn't show up very much. There is a communication between the basilic and the cephalic, and that's the median cubital vein that goes across your elbow. That's one that phlebotomists use a lot to draw blood from people, right? And then down over here, you still have the cephalic vein. All right, so that's pretty much it for veins. Thoracic, adductor, branches, pelvic. Okay. We talked about this kind of vascular system when we looked at the endocrine chapter. Okay, so here is a typical scenario of how most capillaries are connected to our vascular system. So here is an artery that feeds a capillary, and then after this capillary, where does blood go to? It goes to this vein. That's right. So usually there's only one capillary bed. Right? There are some circulations where there are actually two capillary beds back to back, and that's what we call a portal system. And I thought I had a figure of a portal system. Ah, right here. Okay, so here is that artery, blood coming from the heart. It feeds this first capillary, right? And all these capillaries are joined back together to form a vein. But then before it goes back to the heart, via this vein right here, it goes to another organ. And there is a capillary in the second organ. So we're going to call this the second capillary bed. And then it goes back to the vena cava and then to the heart. So there are two capillary beds back to back, and here is the portal blood vessel. Anybody remember the name of the portal blood vessel between the hypothalamus and the pituitary gland by any chance? That was the hypothalamo hypophyseal portal blood vessel. Right, that was, I think, even on your exam last time. Yeah, that was on your exam last time. All right, so the first capillary bed was in the hypothalamus. The second capillary bed was in, oh, you got to know that. Where is that second capillary bed in the hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal system? Okay, it's pituitary. What part of the pituitary? Anterior part. Yeah, the anterior part. Because the posterior part is nervous tissue, and those neurons release hormones directly. Okay, so here is a portal system. And in particular, I see liver right here. So that tells me something special about this portal system. This is the hepatic portal system. Every time you hear that word HEPA, something that has to do with liver. So why is this blood going to the liver? Well, here we're in the first capillary bed. Our body is absorbing a lot of nutrients, right, as well as other things that are in our food, toxins, things that are deleterious to our body. That's in the blood. Right? And it's important to detoxify as many of those chemicals as possible before it goes back to your circulation. So it's the job of the liver to process this blood, to get rid of those toxins, and also to process some other nutrients, maybe like fatty acids, for instance, and then that blood is returned to the rest of the body. So this is a special door-to-door delivery system. So blood goes from one organ directly to the next, right before it goes back to the usual circulation. So what is happening in these capillary beds? What do we see happening? Exchange. That's right. So here I see things that are in the interstitial space. They're entering a capillary, right? And then the blood ends up over here, and I can see those same things leaving a capillary. And remember, things can only enter or leave through a capillary. Other blood vessels are just way too thick to allow that to happen. Okay, so you have that in your notes, the hepatic portal system. So what empties into this hepatic portal system? You have a gastric vein. Where does that come from? The stomach, yeah. Splenic vein, where does that come from? Spleen, right? And then superior and inferior mesenteric veins. These come from the intestines, right? And all that blood is processed. So there are capillaries, right, in the stomach and spleen and intestines that pick up things that are in the digestive tract. That blood goes into this hepatic portal vein, goes into the liver where there's a second capillary system. After the liver processes the blood, then the blood ends up in a hepatic vein, which then goes to the inferior vena cava and the right atrium. All right, so that's the hepatic system. Go back and look at that pituitary system. That's really important that you guys should never forget about that one, okay? Because you'll talk about that in physiology a lot, or if you ever take an endocrinology class, that's really important to know. Okay, fetal circulation, we do that in lab. There's also nice videos in the in Blackboard under practicums. So unless somebody has a question sometime between now and the end of the semester, I probably won't go over the fetal circulation. All right, or if I have time at the end of lymphatics. Okay, so where the heck are we? What's next? Lymphatic system, chapter 21. Okay, so the lymphatic system is an auxiliary circulatory system, but it doesn't circulate. It just goes in one direction, right? Unlike the vascular system. So let me pull up some notes. Lymphatic system. Okay, so what are the components of the lymphatic system? Well, there's a fluid. We call that lymph. And it's sort of like a plasma that we have in our blood, but it doesn't have clotting factors in it. And it shouldn't have any red blood cells in there. It might have some white blood cells, monocytes if they leave the vascular system. And it also has other white blood cells like lymphocytes. All right, so I might have different kinds of lymphocytes. And this fluid and these cells can flow from one place to another via the vessels of the lymphatic system. And the fluid that's in the lymphatic system is moving back to the heart. Before it gets back to the heart, it has to go through a lymph node. And the other parts of the lymphatic system are tonsils, spleen, thymus gland. I think we talked about the thymus gland, but this is where T lymphocytes go to mature, to become competent to fight infection. All right? The tonsils and spleen are there to filter blood and to mount an immune response to infectious agents, both bacteria and viruses. All right, so this is the composition. All right, the function. It maintains fluid balance. Let's consider this. There are about 30 liters of plasma that pass out of capillaries every day into your interstitial spaces at the proximal end of a capillary. So 30 liters, that's a lot. Does anybody have a liter container of anything? That maybe looks like not even half a liter. It's really, really small. Is that a liter? That's really close, maybe. Yeah, that's a liter. So 30 of those things actually go through all of the tissue spaces in our body, right, that leaves the proximal end. And then at the distal end of a capillary, 27 liters gets resorbed and put back into the vascular system. That's important because otherwise we would dehydrate very rapidly. But you're probably wondering, gee whiz, where does all that other fluid go? There's 3 liters left that's stuck in tissue spaces, right? So if we didn't have a lymphatic system, our body would swell up, right, by 3 times whatever the size of that bottle was. And then the next day, again, 3 times that, and we would just swell up like a big balloon and maybe even bust like a balloon sometimes. So where does all this fluid go? It gets resorbed into lymphatic vessels. So let's look at some lymphatic vessels. Okay, so here is the heart. Here's a systemic artery. Here's a capillary. Here is a systemic vein. And remember, 30 liters pass out of a capillary every day, but only 27 gets picked up on the way out. The rest of that fluid, 3 liters, pass through the lymphatic system on the way to the subclavian vein. And on its way, it has to pass through these lymph nodes. So lymph always passes through at least one lymph node before it gets back to the circulatory system. And the job of that lymph node, right, is to filter blood to make sure there are no pathogens in it. That's the job of these lymph nodes. And if there are bacteria, right, in your circulatory system, then these lymph nodes get really busy. They start to grow, and they produce antibodies, and they produce other kinds of cells that will fight that infection. So sometimes, maybe if you've seen a physician and you have an infection, maybe they palpated your neck, right? What they're feeling for are these lymph nodes that are enlarged fighting that infection. All right, so when I look at this lymphatic system right here, I see it kind of reminds me of a vein, kind of reminds me of a heart. Why does the lymphatic system have some similarities with the heart and veins? What do you see? I think I heard it someplace over here. Well, I'm pointing to it. There are valves, right? Just like the heart has valves, veins have valves. Right? Because the pressure of the lymphatic system is very, very low, these valves have to be right here to prevent the retrograde or the reverse flow of blood back down to this capillary. All right, so lymph always flows back to the heart or to the subclavian vein. Okay, so how does lymph get into a lymph node? Via a lymph capillary. All right, so there's really no circulation in the lymph. It only goes in one direction. All right, so tissue fluid enters a lymph capillary, right, and then it makes its way back to the heart. How does it get inside that lymph capillary? If we're to zoom in to the end of a lymph capillary, here is a little flap, right? And it can flap open and close, flap open and close. And when it opens up, tissue fluid enters the lymphatic system. And when it closes, right, then it starts to make its way back to the heart because of the valves, right, including this little flap-like mini valve. So here is the end, or actually the beginning of the lymphatic system. So it's not like a regular capillary. The lymphatic system not only helps maintain, not only maintains fluid balance in your body, right, it also helps absorb fat from our small intestine. Maybe it's just too loud. Let's see if I turn it down a little bit. All right, so fat is not absorbed in a capillary of the small intestine. It gets absorbed by a lymphatic vessel, and it looks pretty much like this. It's just a dead-end vessel, and that vessel in the small intestine is called a lacteal. That's a vessel that absorbs fat. When fat is absorbed and it combines with lymph, we call that chyle. It's kind of a milky white substance, and then it gets processed before that lymph actually enters the circulatory system. And then the last function of the lymphatic system, which we kind of talked to about already, is that it's for immune response. Lymph nodes filter lymph, the spleen filters blood, they contain lymphocytes that can fight infection. And we have this tissue all over our body. Right, and I guess I didn't show you this. Let me see if it's on this slide anywhere. Oh, here. Let's look at this slide. All right, so all of these little hot spots right here are lymphatic organs. Here is the thymus. Here is the spleen, right? And then our tonsils help fight infection as well. And sometimes these tonsils can become chronically infected. What do we call a chronically infected tonsil? Yeah, tonsillitis, right? So the palatines are right in the back of your throat. Commonly, those can be chronically infected, so somebody might come down with a sore throat maybe every week and miss a day of work because they're really, really sick and their throat is really sore, they have a temperature, right? And they might elect to remove those tonsils from the body with a tonsillectomy. And it will be amazing because that same person, right, after they recuperate, won't have a sore throat or an infection of the throat for weeks and weeks and weeks, maybe months, maybe not even the whole following year after that. All right, so that's pretty amazing. That could change somebody's life. Well, the only downside is that if you're an adult, I think you get at least 4 weeks off from work because it takes a long time to recuperate from removing tonsils. All right, but if you're just a little kid, you recuperate very quickly after that, probably in about a week. And these tonsils are about as big as that distal segment on your thumb, right there in the back of your throat. So if you were to take out a lump of tissue the size of your thumb in the back of your throat, you can imagine how sore you would be after that. Okay. All right, but nonetheless, if you have chronically infected tonsils, it's great because it will just change your life. Thymus, spleen, here's the appendix. And sometimes, just like these tonsils that have to be removed, the appendix gets inflamed, right, with appendicitis, and it has to be removed. All right, so we could lose our tonsils, we could lose the appendix. The spleen only has reticular connective tissue in it, and it's highly vascular. When it gets damaged, it has a tendency to rip, because what can you tell me about reticular fibers? Reticular fibers are, very weak, the weakest kind of fiber. And since the spleen is highly vascular, then the spleen hemorrhages. And then sometimes the spleen has to be removed. Okay, so I get a lot of questions. Well, what happens when we remove these lymphatic tissues in our body, like the appendix and the spleen? Is that person less resistant to infection after that? And the answer is, not really very much. Your immune response, because you have lymphatic tissue all over the body in places that are associated with a mucosa. We call that mucosa-associated lymphatic tissue. They and the lymph nodes, they just take over the job of whatever organ you're losing, like the appendix, for instance. All right? And the spleen, for most cases. There's only maybe a couple cases where you might be concerned about missing the spleen, and that is if you ever have a prosthesis placed in your body someplace, like a screw to hold bones back together, or a plate, or an artificial hip, for instance. Because that kind of surgery, there's a very high risk of infection, and it's even higher when somebody is missing their spleen. But when the spleen is hemorrhaging so bad, it just has to be removed no matter what. But usually it plays no role whatsoever. All right, so you have lymphatic tissue in these organs, right? But all over the place. That's what we call MALT, mucosa-associated lymphatic tissue. And we have that in the digestive system, respiratory, urinary, reproductive tracts, and they contain germinal centers along with lymph nodes. So what the heck is a germinal center? Well, what does it mean to germinate? What happens when something germinates? What's happening? Anybody ever grow any seeds or anything? Take a seed, put it in the right conditions, maybe some moist soil, and it grows into a plant, right? So it turns from a seed into a plant. That's what we call germination. So how does a seed turn into a plant? Well, there's a lot of cell division, there's a lot of mitosis, and then it starts to grow. So there's growth associated with this germinal center. But that growth is a way to fight infection by producing antibodies. Right? So sometimes when you have an infection, you can palpate lymph nodes because it's a germinal center help fighting infection. Right? But we have these germinal centers all over the place in our body. All right, so here is an example of a lymph node. Right? We talked about the capillaries, vessels, and just like blood and veins, it gets back to the subclavian by contraction of skeletal muscle. But there's also smooth muscle in the wall of lymphatic vessels that help push blood back to the heart. And also the respiratory pump also helps return lymph back to the subclavian vein, just like it does for venous blood. Okay, so here is a lymph node. And I can see many lymph vessels entering this lymph node, and there might be one or two vessels that leave. Right, so the vessel that enters, we're going to call that an afferent vessel. The lymph vessel that leaves is what we're going to call efferent. So that shouldn't be too strange to remember. Right, so in a lymph node, we have the capsule, and then on the interior of the lymph node, we have germinal centers. Right, so when you have an infection, then these germinal centers right here and right here and right here start to grow and proliferate. When we say proliferate, that's maybe like another term for germination. Right, proliferation, remember in skin we had a layer that we don't name this very often, but it's the stratum basale, that's the growing layer, it's proliferating. And we call that the stratum germinativum sometimes. You might hear stratum germinativum. All right, so these cells are dividing by mitosis, learning how to fight that infection. Some of them even enter the lymphatic system. Some go to the thymus to become T lymphocytes. And a T lymphocyte in the thymus, because they're Ts, it's really easy to remember, they're a contact killer. Right, so these lymph cells, it's a white blood cell, when they bump into a foreign cell, then they grab onto it and actually lyse that cell. They make the cell explode. Right, so that's a contact killer. Another kind of lymphocyte is a B lymphocyte. B lymphocytes are not contact killers, but they produce antibodies, which are compounds that the B lymphocyte secretes into the blood, so it's just a very large molecule that can bind to bacteria or other kinds of infectious agents, right? And then the cell, those cells lyse after that. So there are two main ways to fight infection, right? With lymphocytes, one is a T lymphocyte, the other is a B lymphocyte. So just think of a contact killer versus antibody killer from the B cell. Okay. So how does lymph get back? All right, so here we see a whole bunch of lymph vessels. And we can see that they're just dead-end vessels with little mini-valves at the end. And lymph starts to flow back to the subclavian, and it has to pass through at least one lymph node. And there are some places in your body that have a superficial aggregation of lymph nodes, like the cervical region, the axial region, inguinal region right here, and a physician might actually palpate these to find out if you just have a regional infection or a systemic infection, because lymph nodes will be enlarged everywhere in the body. All right, so remember those superficial aggregates of lymph nodes. Then lymph is, you might notice that this person right here has two different colors, right? And it's not symmetrical. And that's because lymph gets back to the subclavian vein two different ways. It just so happens that it's asymmetrical like this. So on the right side of the body, blood goes back via the lymphatic vessel to the subclavian. Gee whiz, can I see that in here? Sort of, not really. Okay, it's right here. So this right here is what we call the lymphatic duct from the right side. So it drains lymph from the right side of the head, the right thorax, and the right upper appendage. But that's it. Okay, the other side, left side of the head, left thorax, left upper, and left lower appendage. Right? Both the left and right lower appendage go into the left subclavian vein. So there's a lot of funny asymmetry right here. This right here is called the thoracic duct. It's a, you could consider this like the inferior vena cava, right? That brings blood back to the subclavian vein. Here is an enlargement at the beginning of the thoracic duct that we call the cisterna chyli. Right, but know that drainage of the lymphatic system, right, is shows this dramatic asymmetry in our body. Okay, every once in a while somebody might have a cancer in a part of their body, maybe breast cancer, right, or maybe cancer in the abdomen, and those cancer cells are filtered out by a lymph node, right, and then those lymph nodes should be removed from the body as well. All right, so let's consider removing all of these lymph nodes here in the inguinal region. What would be a consequence of that? I would like you to think about what the function, one of the functions of the lymphatic vessel is, and if it's gone, what are some of the consequences? That was actually the first item in the function of a lymphatic vessel. What does it do? Let's not think about fighting infection. Let's think about maintaining fluid balance. Yeah, returning fluid back to the heart. So if you don't have a lymphatic system in some part of the body returning fluid back to the heart, it stays in that area. What do we call that? We should know what that's called. Okay, that's a, then that part of the body swells up. We call it edema. Edema. So removing these lymphatic vessels produces an edema or a swelling in that part of the body. Okay, contain, let's see what else. Lymphocytes, bone marrow carried by the blood to lymph organs. Okay, so germinal centers can be activated by foreign substances, and a lot of times we just like to call these foreign substances antigens. So you could consider a bacteria antigens because they have, on the outside of those cells, they have certain markers. which are different than you find in your body. And so those markers are really what the antigens are, but they're attached to a bacterium. And when a germ center becomes activated, right, then it starts to proliferate and produce lymphocytes. We call that immune system activation. So where does immune system activation take place? Where does it take place? Just according to this little sentence right here. It takes place, immune system activation takes place in germinal centers in your body. Okay, like lymph nodes, tonsils, appendix, all those other places that we've been talking about. Okay, the tonsils protect your body against infection from bacteria that are entering your body via your oral cavity or nasal cavity. And you have three kinds, palatine, posterior oral cavity. You have some in the nasal cavity. All right, let me see. Maybe I can pull these up. Okay, so here are the ones in the oral cavity. Those are the palatine tonsils. Right? Here is the here are the pharyngeal tonsils. Oh no, they're underneath the tongue. These are the lingual tonsils. Okay, so here are the tonsils. Lymph nodes. We talked about those superficial aggregations. The function of a lymph node is to filter lymph and produce lymphocytes. It's a germinal center, so it can help activate the immune system. And there are monocytes, which turn into macrophages, right, which can engulf pathogens and destroy them. All right, so let's look at go back to here. All right, so this might be an exam figure. All right, so know the afferent vessels and the efferent vessels. And again, you can see some valves right here. Invaginations of the capsule we call trabeculae, and that forms little rooms, right, inside the lymph node. And we call that a follicle. Right? And a follicle has a sinus. This is where blood leaves, or I'm sorry, this is where lymph, right, percolates between all of these different cells right here, and it passes through the germinal center. And these cells are looking for pathogens. So these germinal centers we call medullary cords. Remember, medulla is a deep part of any kind of organ. And we can even see a sinus. So here's a sinus, here's a sinus. This collects lymph after it's been filtered back into an efferent lymphatic vessel. All right, the spleen has similar kind of tissues. All right, so here is the spleen, and you can see how highly vascular it is. So it has an arterial supply. The spleen isn't connected to a lot of lymph vessels, but it is to the circulatory system. So the job of a lymph node is to filter lymph, but the job of the spleen is to filter blood. All right, so it's performing the same function, but on two different kinds of fluids. And the capillaries in the sinus are very leaky. And so blood comes in these arteries and it moves through all of these sinuses. Blood just percolates between all of the different cells. And then it gets resorbed by the splenic vein. Okay, and the splenic vein goes to the hepatic portal vein. And then that goes to the liver for additional processing. All right, so just like a node, there are trabeculae. And there are germinal centers. We can see red pulp, right, and white pulp right over here. And it has two different functions, right? So the red pulp filters red blood cells, and the white pulp does what? It's a germinal center because it can activate the immune system. All right, so here is lymphatic system, which can be germinal centers. Another job of this red pulp right here is, remember, red blood cells only live for about 120 days. and then they die. Right, so old and damaged red blood cells are removed from the circulatory system with red pulp, or within the red pulp. And then those components are recycled back into maybe new red blood cells in red bone marrow. And remember, spleen only it has no collagen. It only has reticular fibers, and that's why it's easily traumatized. The thymus, I think we talked about that. That's where T lymphocytes go to gain competence to fight infection. And you know that to be in the mediastinum. So that's pretty much it for lymphatic system. See if there's anything else. All right, so red pulp filters blood, white pulp filters lymph. So how does lymph get into a lymph vessel? How does lymph get into a lymph vessel? What do we call that structure? Yeah, a lymph node filters lymph, all right, and a lymph node gets lymph from a lymph vessel, from an afferent vessel. But I'm just wondering, how does an afferent vessel acquire lymph? How does lymph get into an afferent vessel? What kind of vessel allows for exchange? A capillary, right? So there is a lymphatic capillary, right? Right at the end or the terminus of a afferent lymphatic vessel that collects interstitial fluid, and it becomes lymph. Okay, so that's all I have to say about the lymphatic system. All right, so let's get a little view of the respiratory system. Okay, so here is the respiratory system. We have the nasal cavity. We also have the oral cavity. They are connected together, so you can breathe through your mouth or your nose. And the back of the oral cavity is called the pharynx. So when you have a sore throat, we call that a pharyngitis, right? When you have an infection of the larynx, so here is the beginning of the windpipe. Here's the larynx. If you have laryngitis, what's one symptom of laryngitis? And so a sore throat is a pharyngitis, but a laryngitis produces what kind of observable effect? Yeah, you lose your voice, right? Because here are in the larynx, you have vocal cords, and when they get inflamed, right, then you lose your voice as a result of that. So we got the oral cavity and nasal cavity. We have the pharynx, and then air goes into the trachea. Here's the trachea on its way to the lungs. And this little tube is the esophagus. And it's going to go down over here. And so there's material in the esophagus that goes to the stomach. So what is the esophagus conducting? It's not conducting air, but what's passing through here? Yeah, food down into the stomach. All right, and so we see that the trachea is anterior, the esophagus is posterior, it's behind the trachea. All of these blue, do they look blue to you, these things right here? Yeah, no? Kind of purple, okay, that's a shade of blue. All right, all of these shades of blue right here represent cartilage. All right, so the trachea has cartilage. A bronchus has cartilage, so the trachea, once it bifurcates, that becomes a bronchus. The larynx is also made out of cartilage, and that's one of the figures that you have to label today. When we look at when we look at this larynx right here, I see the epiglottis. And the epiglottis is a trapdoor, so that when you swallow food, for instance, this trapdoor closes, this opening to the trachea, which we call the glottis, and food slides over the epiglottis into the esophagus right here. All right, but these cartilages hold the larynx open all the time, hold the trachea all the time, and that has some clinical significance. And that is, if there is a particle that gets into the larynx right here, because the trachea is held open all the time, guess where it's going to go? Because of gravity, it's just going to fall into the trachea. It might fall all the way down to a bronchus right over here. And what do we call that when something gets stuck? Because we should only have air in this trachea. What do we call that when something gets stuck in air passageway? I think I kind of heard it. Yeah, that's choking, right? That's called choking. Choking is not good because that will prevent breathing, right? And then your blood won't be oxygenated. You'll have a little bit of oxygen in your blood, so there are a couple circulations that take place before you pass out, but it will happen pretty rapidly. So what is a way, does anybody know how to clear an airway that has a blockage because maybe some food fell in here? Yeah, Heimlich maneuver. If you're CPR certified, you've learned how to thrust all of the abdominal contents up into the diaphragm that pressurizes whatever air is in the lungs, right? And then hopefully something will just shoot right out of the trachea right into somebody's oral cavity or nasal cavity. All right, so those of you that are CPR certified, there is a day of the week where people have a tendency to choke. And there's a time on that particular day that people have a tendency to choke. So if you're certified, probably should pay a little bit of attention to that particular day and that particular time. Who knows what day it is? What day of the week do most people choke? Okay. It's on a Friday. So it's Fridays, right? So not Mondays, Saturdays or Sundays. It's on Fridays. And what time on a Friday? It's like at happy hour, 5 o'clock, okay? So it's usually associated with adult beverage, right? And you're out with some friends, and you're having a nice time. Everybody's telling jokes, and you're eating some popcorn shrimp or nachos or something. And so you're about ready to swallow, right, some popcorn or something, just when somebody tells a joke, oh, yeah, my anatomy instructor did something. And just as you're swallowing, you start to laugh and you inhale, right? And there goes that particle right into the trachea. All right, so Friday evening is a typical time, especially in public places associated with adult beverage. But I suppose that could happen at home too, right? If you're home by 5 o'clock on a Friday. Okay, so the trachea is held open all the time because of this cartilage. Why do you think the trachea is held open all the time? How come it's just not a tube like this esophagus, which has smooth muscle in it? It's good to know why that is. All right, so the esophagus is closed, right? Or when we exhale, the esophagus has a tendency to shrink down, to clamp down. So if the trachea was not held open, when we compress our chest to exhale, it would collapse as well. So all of this cartilage prevents the collapsing of this tube, because if it were to collapse, then air would not be able to leave the lungs. So that's why all of that cartilage is there. All right, so the functions of this respiratory system: move air in and out of the lungs, right? And also gas exchange between air that's in the lungs, right? So air in these different passageways, and capillaries, blood capillaries that are in the lungs. Right, and then it transports that oxygenated blood back to the heart, which then goes to the rest of the body. What kind of blood vessel brings oxygenated blood back to the heart? What kind of blood vessel brings blood back from the lungs to the heart? Name that blood vessel. The pulmonary vein. And on that pulmonary vein, if you were going to color it red or blue, red signifying oxygenated blood, what color would you label that pulmonary vein? Red. Right? So the pulmonary system is opposite compared to the systemic circulation. All right, so please don't forget that. Then there's gas exchange, right, in the systemic circulation, in systemic capillaries between blood and tissues. So oxygen, nutrients will leave the circulatory system into tissues. And what kind of blood vessel would that take place in? A capillary, right, a capillary, because that's the only place where exchange can happen. All right, so let's look at some of the anatomy. Respiratory tract, right? Nose, nasopharynx, oropharynx, laryngopharynx, nasal cavity, and pharynx. Let's see if we can find some of these things. All right, so the back of your oral cavity is what we call the pharynx, right? And we break it up into three different regions. Right, so right up over here, this is what we call the nasopharynx in the back of the nasal cavity. Here is the oropharynx, that just exactly posterior to the oral cavity. And here is the larynx. Just behind the larynx is the laryngopharynx. All right, so what the heck is pharynx? Pharynx is a common pathway for air that we breathe and also food that we eat. Right, that's a good way to think of the pharynx. The larynx, on the other hand, should never have food in it. It should only have air. Right, and so it's the job of this epiglottis to flop over this opening in the larynx, so food goes into the esophagus on its way to the stomach. That opening in the larynx is what we call the glottis. So the glottis is just the foramen, and it's a passageway for food and things that we drink. All right, so those are important regions of the pharynx. I think this is... Did you have to label this last time in lab? I think so. Okay, so what do we see? Well, we see some palatine tonsils, pharyngeal tonsils, lingual tonsil. All right, and here's the nasal cavity. Here's where the nasal conchae are. You had to learn these when we were studying bones. Right, so this inferior nasal conchae is a bone all by itself, but the superior and middle are part of the, does anybody know what part the superior and middle nasal conchae from? They're from the ethmoid bone, right? They're little shelves on the ethmoid bone. And these nasal conchae have a mucous membrane over them, which has a tendency to trap dust particles, so dust doesn't get down into our lungs. But it also humidifies the air as we're breathing in so that our lungs don't turn into potato chips. And if the air is hot, it helps cool the air down so we don't burn our lungs. And if the air is really cold, it does what? It warms the air up so that we don't freeze our lungs. So it does a number of important things. Okay, then in the oral cavity, we have the tongue. We have the isthmus of the fauces. This is how a material in your oral cavity enters the oral pharynx. And here's the posterior nasal aperture. That's how air enters the nasopharynx. Okay, and you can begin now to see some cartilages. We talked about the epiglottis. Here is part of the thyroid cartilage, and it's poking out. Right, so that's an easy to identify landmark. You can palpate that on yourself. So that's the anterior part of the larynx. And it doesn't go all the way around the larynx, but there is a cartilage that does completely encircle the larynx, and that is the cricoid cartilage. But it is large posteriorly and kind of small anteriorly. I suppose you could palpate the cricoid cartilage right there, right? But it's much easier to palpate this thyroid cartilage. If we look at the roof of the mouth, right here is part of the maxilla, and then here this would be a suture, and then anybody know what the name of this little bone is right here? Yeah, palatine. So the palatine bone and the maxilla help make the hard palate on the roof of your mouth, and then here is the soft palate. There are muscles and mucous membranes that isolates the or it can't isolate the nasal cavity from the oral cavity. And it can isolate the oral cavity from the oropharynx as well. Sometimes somebody's born with a malformation of the hard palate. And so there's a passageway between the nasal cavity and the oral cavity. It's called a cleft palate. And that's a very dangerous circumstance. If there is a hole right here, why might you think that's a very dangerous circumstance? Okay. Well, when somebody's eating, right, instead of food going into the esophagus, it can go up into the nasal cavity. Right? Or if there's a malformation of the soft palate, when somebody swallows, then the soft palate can't close off, right, the posterior nasal aperture. And again, food can enter the nasal cavity. And when you can't eat, you can't thrive. And so that is a fatal circumstance, especially for newborns. This also, the hard palate and soft palate have to be correct, as well as this little tether. I don't have a picture of this, but this is what we call a frenulum. Stick your tongue out when you get home, and you'll see that right in the very center of your tongue, there's going to be a ridge, and that's called the frenulum. That would be the lingual frenulum. There's also one on the lower lip. That would be the labial frenulum. And if that is tethered, then an infant won't be able to produce suction in the oral cavity. And again, that infant won't thrive and will die. But usually, so sometimes that's hard to detect, but it always, one way that has to be checked out right away, if somebody is nursing and has mastitis, then that's really one of the first things that somebody should check. Not the mother, but the infant might not be nursing properly, right, and might be irritating the breast because they're trying to suck and suckle, but just can't because of malformation within the oral cavity, like this lingual frenulum, hard palate, or soft palate. So here, anterior view of the larynx and also some cartilages on the trachea. So that these are what we call tracheal cartilages or rings, although they don't completely encircle the trachea. They're formed like a C. And that's because there has to be a place for when you swallow a bolus of food, it has to bump up against the trachea, and if it was a solid ring posteriorly, then that would impede flow through the esophagus. So what are some of these cartilages? Well, here's that Adam's apple, right? This is the thyroid cartilage. Here is the cricoid cartilage down underneath it. And here is the epiglottis. So most of the larynx is made out of hyaline cartilage, but the epiglottis, because it's moving around all the time, it's made out of elastic cartilage, right? So that just has more elastic fibers in it. Okay, I think that's maybe an illustration of what you have to do in lab. If not, here it is. All right, so here is that cricoid cartilage completely encircling the larynx. Here's that epiglottis, thyroid cartilage, and the thyroid cartilage doesn't go all the way around to the back, even though it kind of looks like the largest cartilage. Actually, this cricoid cartilage is the largest. Then, right above the cricoid cartilage, we have the arytenoid. And I think that's really all I want for you to know in lab. The epiglottis, thyroid, cricoid, and arytenoid. And the arytenoids are kind of special because they can apply tension to a vocal cord. Right? So here is a false vocal cord. It's just a fold in the larynx. Here is the true vocal cord. So this arytenoid can put tension on this true vocal cord, and that will change the pitch of somebody's voice. Right, so how does something vibrate when you put more tension on it? How does the vibration change? Does the vibration get faster or does it get slower? It gets faster, right? So when you want to talk or you want to sing in a high pitch, okay, then these arytenoids put a lot of tension on the vocal cord and the pitch then of your voice is going to be higher, right? But when you're just talking normally, the pitch of your voice is lower, and then the arytenoid cartilage does not put tension onto this vocal cord. So those, and then up on top, corniculate cartilage. I don't think I have you know anything about the corniculate. You can kind of see them in lab sometimes. Okay? And what the heck is the glottis? What is the glottis? The glottis is the opening, right, from the laryngopharynx into the larynx. Right, that's so the glottis is just a hole. Okay, so here you can see thyroid cartilage, you can see the arytenoid cartilage, and they're attached to these vocal cords, vocal ligaments, and there are muscles that can pull and put tension, angulate, or rotate these arytenoids to put tension on these vocal cords. And it will change the pitch of sound that you can make. We don't have any really good models in lab, right? But right smack in the center, these are what we call the true vocal cords, right here. And then on either side, okay, and the opening is the glottis, on either side we have the false or vestibular folds, the false vocal cords. So here we have transverse section of the trachea. All right, so here is some nice hyaline cartilage. Here is the esophagus, a couple layers of smooth muscle, and a mucosa. We're going to look at that in the next chapter. And unlike the trachea that is held open all the time, the esophagus is compressed and it's closed. So just like the trachea, when it's held open all the time, has a clinical significance because things can fall into it. The esophagus, there are some important things about the esophagus when we get to the digestive system, because it's closed all the time, has some clinical significance as well. But things can't fall into the esophagus because it's closed. I think everybody looked at a slide of the trachea, and it was a pseudostratified ciliated columnar epithelium. So all these lines right here represent cilia. And what could you tell me, what about the function of cilia? What does it do? Yeah, it's for motility, right? And there are goblet cells in that lining as well. Goblet cells secrete mucus onto the surface of that epithelium, and that mucus can help trap dust particles and bacteria. All right, and since the cilia are sweeping, which way do you think they sweep? Do they sweep down? Or do they sweep in a circle, or do they sweep up? Or do they sweep back and forth? Up, down, or all around? What would you guess? What would you guess? How about if it was sweeping down, where would all that junk go? It would be in your lungs. Yeah, your lungs would fill up with mucus and junk. So these cilia, for sure, are sweeping up into your oral cavity, right? So all of that, all those dust particles, bacteria, things that just contain in there, and there's a lot of stuff contained in there every time they breathe. Right? And then when it's in your oral cavity, what do you do? What do you do with all that junk? You just swallow it down. Okay? Get rid of it. Unless you're a baseball player, then what do you do? Then you spit. Somebody said that over there. Then you can spit. But typically, we don't spit too much. Okay. So that pseudostratified ciliated columnar epithelium with goblet cells. Okay, let's look at some branches. Next time when we start, right, we need to look at some, what figures might you want to look at when we come back? You might want to look at this figure right here. Okay, so make sure you sign the sign-in sheet.